Hi, this is Pep Phelan from the Poach Centre for Indigenous Health at Melbourne University, and I have with me today Hilary Aldenhoven. Hi, Hilary.
Hi, how are you going, Pep?
I'm good. What's going on?
Just surviving during COVID.
Yeah. So tell me more about yourself, Hilary, where you're from, your profession, and how you got into it.
Well, I'm a proud Noongi woman. My mob makes up one of the three mobs of the Quandamooka people from Mindjeriba and Moorgumpin. So that's North Stradbroke Island and Moreton Island in Queensland. But I live down here in Melbourne on Wurundjeri country. I'm a social worker and predominantly worked in sort of mental health and the forensic mental health space. I've got a Bachelor of Social Work, and then I commenced my Master's in Forensic Behavioural Science, but I ended up just kind of finishing up at the graduate certificate. That's kind of my history.
And what got you interested in going into social work? As opposed to anything else you might have been interested in when you were younger?
I guess in school, I didn't really try very hard in school. I wasn't really that interested in school, but I used to volunteer when I was younger with kids with who have disabilities and go on camps and do that kind of stuff. And I guess when I got to year 12, my dad was sort of like, oh, you need to go off to university. And I just sort of thought, oh, well, I'll do social work. And I actually didn't really know what social work was, but I knew that, I guess, in me, I wanted to do something with people and that, you know, like social work probably was something that kind of aligned with kind of my values and my beliefs. And then I guess I went into university and then I finished my social work degree. And then, yeah, I sort of ended up in mental health and I guess never really looked back and thought, well, yeah, that was a good kind of snap decision I made right at the end of school. I remember I had to get an enter score of 80, I think, to get into the uni that I want to go to. And I ended up getting 80.5.
Amazing.
You know, like one of those things where it's just like I put my effort into it and just the right amount so I could do what I wanted to do. It's interesting, like, because I was never really, I guess, education orientated.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you like most about social work?
I think it's about connecting with people. And I guess I find it's such a privilege to be part of people's journey, but also to, you know, hear people's stories and be able to have impact on people's lives. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're doing social work, it can be a thankless job a lot of the time, and it can be really stressful, and it's really hard work. But you know, there'll be these moments in time where you might run into somebody that you've worked with in the past and they remember you and might tell you, like, what you did then really helped me. And so I think, like, the clients keep me motivated to keep doing what I want to do. And I guess, like, in mental health, I have a lot of family members who have got mental health issues. I guess it's not surprising that I've kind of ended up in mm-hmm. this space. And I guess, you know, for our mob, mental health is something that impacts on us greatly, and it's also something that we are misdiagnosed and underdiagnosed and overrepresented sort of in a lot of kind of mental health and the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. Yet, you know, we're a group of people that are sort of, although we're overrepresented, we're underrepresented in treatment and engagement. And that's because of, you know, a range of factors, including, you know, stigma, racism, you know, past mistreatment and mistrust of government, but also the treatment that is provided doesn't adopt a social emotional wellbeing approach, and there's not a cultural lens applied to treatment, and it's a very Western kind of medical model, one size kind of fits all approach, which just doesn't work for us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess in my role, being able to have influence on that and try and advocate for cultural safety and advocate for, you know, including culture and spirituality and other methods of healing into mental health treatment, like that is so important, and that kind of drives me to continue doing what I do. And, you know, like I work at the moment, I work in a mainstream program that works with, you know, everybody. But I think if we can adopt a more sort of social emotional wellbeing holistic approach to mental health care, it can help everyone. Like it's not, mm-hmm. It's not just going to improve health outcomes for our mob. It's going to improve it for everyone, because a sort of westernized model of care isn't necessarily the best approach.
Yeah, so I find it really interesting that Western models of mental health care, which should be person-centered, should be recovery-oriented, still don't encompass the holistic perspective on mental health that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander social and emotional wellbeing does. So in what way do you think Western services could be improved using Indigenous models of mental health?
It's a good question, and it's a complex question. And it's one that I'll probably be kind of chipping away at for the rest of my career. But I guess like one of the striking things, like within that role and within a lot of the roles that I've sort of been in the mental health, forensic mental health space within the prison and the community, is that, you know, there's not a lot of Aboriginal clinicians in this space. And it's kind of like, I guess from my perspective, I've always found it very difficult navigating these spaces because I've been the only person in this space. You can have sort of ideas about changing sort of this interaction for this person to improve, you know, one person's experience of the mental health system. But in order to actually make changes that are actually going to impact everyone, it's like a complete, I guess, overhaul of the system. And, you know, I know at the moment there's a Royal Commission into mental health, and I think that I've had some involvement in that, and I think there will be changes. But I think for our mob, it's about moving a like in terms of like diagnosis and assessment and things. Assessments are done in a way, like a lot of the time in a sort of a clinical setting, and it's somebody sitting there with a, you know, clipboard taking notes and all of that sort of stuff. So like from the get-go, like the environment and the way things, like the way rooms are set up, the way people engage, like that sort of stuff is really, like, really important. And some of the work that I do with some of the psychiatrists and stuff at my work is about trying to break down those power dynamics and change the dialogue and the language, adapting people's assessment style and not just doing things the same way as they've always done it and going through the same set of questions, because that's kind of, you know, that's how we do things. And so in the environment and the way that treatment and assessment is provided, but then I guess we're using Western models of assessment to assess mental health in our community. And that, again, like it doesn't fit with our own construction of health. Like mental health for us is not a separate kind of illness off to the side. It's part of, like what you were saying before, it's part of a greater sort of sense of social and emotional well-being that is for the individual and the community or the person's connections. I guess mental health treatment, like it has to be less individualized. That's one of the things, I guess, with the new change in Mental Health Act, is that a lot of the treatment and stuff now is very individualized. And family involvement, like although maybe it's been streamlined a little bit, it's not necessarily mandated either in a lot of ways. And so if you're looking at the healthcare of the individual, you need to look at it within their family and within their community. It can't just be, you know, I guess for a lot of our clients, it's the first point of call is let's get medication and then we'll look at all of the other stuff. But, you know, why can't we flip that the other way? And looking at more holistic ways of providing care. I know for myself, like I'm a saltwater person, and being on my country and being near the ocean, like that's really healing for me. And that sort of stuff is not necessarily recognized within sort of a medical model as important. And the other thing is about strengthening people's cultural identity. Like that's key to improving people's mental health. I know a lot of clinicians and stuff that I've worked with and dealt with over the years, often I think are worried about saying the wrong thing or asking the wrong thing. So they end up actually ignoring people's cultural identity and ignoring people's culture because they're so worried about offending people. But that is just so disempowering for us. And then we become invisible.
What came up in my mind when you're talking about all of that is obviously practices of cultural competency, cultural safety, but more so cultural humility, you know, just understanding that your way isn't the best way, that we're on a lifelong journey of learning about one another. And if we can center our practices on the person that we're working with in a collaborative way, then everyone's going to have a fantastic journey together.
And I, you know, and it's like, it's about services working together and being able to provide like, collaborative treatment and not having people to sort of retell their story and have their needs like met in different, like a lot of the time people have to have their mental health treatment over there and their drug and alcohol treatment there, and they see their doctor over there and then their counselor over there. Like it's not like, in an ideal world, this stuff would all be kind of done in sort of the one kind of space, and people wouldn't be, because I think, you know, the experience of a lot of our clients is they're broken up into pieces, like in that person, I have to go to this area to fix that piece and this, you know, like, and it's not that people need fixing, but it's just like, there's the sense of I can only help you with this, even though you've got all these other things going on. That's not what can be done, and I think that for us, like that's really counterintuitive to the way that we view health and we experience well-being and experience and need healing.
Yeah, those reductionist, fractured biomedical ways of working are kind of the antithesis of the integrated and holistic social and emotional well-being requirements of MOB. I believe that if everyone worked in a more holistic and integrated way, there'd be a hell of a lot better outcomes for everybody.
And that's, yeah, like I guess that's what I was saying before. It's just like if we can adapt to this approach, it's not just going to impact like positively for our mob, it's going to be for everyone.
Through your work, what have you learned about influence, impact, and leadership?
I guess I've learned that leadership comes in, I guess, many different forms, and that, you know, not like a lot of the time I haven't always felt like a leader, even though I've been in lots of positions that, you know, I've probably been perceived as a leader and been put up into that kind of leadership category. And it's particularly probably through the POACH program, I kind of learnt like my own confidence in leadership, and that it was okay that my leadership sort of style is different, but also like I sort of, I guess, gave myself permission to be able to advocate and lead in the ways that I think are important. I guess for us, or for me, like this is, I guess this is my opinion, but I guess I don't like feel as an Aboriginal person like that there is like this thing of leadership. Like from an Aboriginal perspective, leadership is much more, I guess, collective. And I think individuals within communities and stuff all have their expertise and knowledges, and I guess would be, you know, leaders in their space. But we all really need to work together and share that knowledge and share those skills and, you know, continue that kind of development and pass that on to others, to empower other people. But also, I guess, you know, like a lot of more recently I've been doing, I guess, a lot more kind of mentoring and stuff. And that, like, that to me is like really important in terms of leadership. And I'd like that's really empowering to me to see other people and younger people coming along on the journey and getting other people excited and being part of their kind of their journeys.
What does Indigenous leadership mean to you?
I guess Indigenous leadership to me is really, it's different to what maybe a Western kind of view of this one person at the front leading. I think, like I sort of said before, we are a collective kind of culture, and we all play our part within the mob to lead, and we all have our own kind of experiences, and we need to kind of work together and share knowledge and networks. And I guess that's, you know, that's how we get things done, is by, you know, speaking to someone that you know that will put you on to someone else that you know that, you know, has the information or the connections that are going to help you on your journey. It's really, I think, about creating networks and enabling networks. And then it is about, you know, mentoring others and bringing people along and empowering other people with knowledge and skills.
So in what ways can non-Indigenous colleagues learn about leadership and ways of doing, being and knowing from their Indigenous colleagues?
The first thing that comes to mind for me is about listening. And I think a lot of people don't do that enough. And I guess, you know, from what I was taught growing up was, you know, you need to listen. Like, listening is the most important thing. And good Aboriginal allies or non-Aboriginal colleagues could benefit from, you know, listening more and, I guess, creating space for Aboriginal people to be the experts. It's our journey and it's our sort of space to be the experts in. You know, I've spent a lot of time in different roles, in different kind of spaces where I am the only token Black, like a lot of people are very they're really excited to sort of have you there, and they ask you all of these questions, and there's a lot of, I guess you spend a lot of time being the educator. And I'm sick of being the educator. I just, like, that's not my role. Like, I'm not there to, like, you know, in particular roles, I'm there to do what I'm there to do. I'm not there to educate you or to answer any question that you have. And I think listening and putting, like, more importance and more emphasis on the power and the, like, how beneficial it is to have Aboriginal people in the space, and that, you know, seeing it from perspective that it's actually, like, it's a privilege to have Aboriginal people in your space, and it's really powerful, and it's not just something that you can do as a sort of tokenistic thing, because that's what I've found a lot, is that I've gone into spaces and it feels very tokenistic because I am the only Aboriginal person in the role. And then people will sort of make excuses for it or go, yeah, I know, like, it'd be great if we could have more Aboriginal people, but, you know, we don't have the funding or we don't have this. And so it just, like, it just reinforces my feelings of it being really tokenistic. Mm-hmm. And then I end up kind of, you know, like, I step out of those spaces, even though maybe I was doing some good work, because, like, the structure in place just got, like, it doesn't support people to stay. But there is, like, you know, there's obviously individuals there that are really, like, keen, but it's not keen and supportive, it has to sort of come, I think, in these spaces more kind of top down. Like, you can have individuals that are really good and will give you the time and will really value your contribution. But if, like, in these spaces that you're working or inhabiting, if the structure in place isn't changed to make it more kind of culturally safe for the Aboriginal workers and Aboriginal people coming into the space, then it's sort of like, well, the sense is you may as well have not had me there, like,
yeah,
because it's just tokenistic.
Who are the Indigenous leaders that you look up to and why?
In my social work career and in the work that I do, I've always got sort of like my inspiration from the people that, you know, the men and women that I work with. And, you know, I've learned so much from, you know, I guess having the privilege to be part of their journey. And I guess they have been, I guess, really inspirational in my career, like the people that I'm working with and the people, I guess, on the ground doing the work. And I think in social work, a lot of the time, we're the forgotten leaders to the people that are sort of up top. One, like, there's a lot of elders and stuff that I really look up to. And one elder, Auntie Lynn Colleen, she's an Aboriginal wellbeing officer, and she works with the women at one of the prisons. And she is this amazing, beautiful, staunch woman that sort of works tirelessly in the prison with the women. She's the first one to get in and the last one to leave every day. And, you know, I've spent a number of times with her in the prison over the years, and I just think the energy of this lady, like, she's just incredible. But I guess, like, you know, you're talking about these leaders that we look up to, and I guess for me in my work, Dr. Tracy Westerman is someone that she's a woman from the Pilbara in WA. She's a psychologist, and she's, you know, basically spent her whole life looking at improving the assessment tools and mental health assessment of Aboriginal adults and young people, and also suicide prevention. And, you know, like, she's this this amazing presenter, and she does, you know, she does lots of work in the community, but she's like, she's so humble and beautiful, and she will always give you the time of day and will always, you know, be available if you need to have a yarn or whatever. And she's, yeah, she's incredible. Like, and she's, you know, flies around all around the country doing all of this work. And I just, yeah, I'm in awe of her as well. And I guess just lastly, probably the person sort of more close to me is my dad. Like, he is an amazing Aboriginal leader for the community down on the peninsula, and he works sort of day in, day out, pretty much kind of like 24 hours a day. His poor wife never sees him because of, you know, like, that's just, you know, what he does and what he's always done. And I guess he's been a real kind of influence on me and been a really good example of getting on with it.
You mentioned allyship before when we were having a conversation. What does allyship mean to you? And what do you believe the skill sets, knowledges and behaviours are required in order to make a really good ally?
I guess, sort of what I was saying before is about listening, and people need to spend more time listening to us, giving Aboriginal people the space and acknowledging that we are actually the experts, and that their role can be kind of, we need allies. Like, we can't do this on our own, because, you know, we make up only 3% of the population. From my perspective, you know, allies are really important, and there's so many good allies within the community. What makes a good ally is to listen, to take a back seat and give us the front and center to determine what our needs are. The community has all the answers, and we need allies to walk alongside us and to sort of support, well, not maybe not support, but just allow us that space to do what we need to do.
Yeah. For any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person interested in getting into social work, what advice would you give them?
I guess, yeah, I would say do it. I think social work is a really amazing career to get into. It's a humanistic profession, and it is about walking alongside people on their journey. And it's a real kind of privilege to be a social worker and be part of, you know, somebody, like a part of somebody's life, and hear people's stories and be able to advocate for change and challenge systems and challenge the structures and all of the things that have, you know, continued to oppress our people forever. I guess what makes a good social worker, like, if you're causing displeasure and causing a ruckus in systems and in structures, and advocating for your clients and going against the grain, that makes a good social worker. And I think, you know, a lot of us have that kind of fight in us. And so I think, yeah, for young people, get into social work. Previously, like, I know in early on in my career, when I said to people that I was a social worker or I was studying social work, there's this kind of quite a negative kind of connotation for social work, because, you know, social workers took our children away and historically have done a lot of not so great things. Yeah, I remember getting that kind of backlash of, oh, what do you want to do that for? But I feel like now I am a social worker, I can enact so much change. You know, it's a really powerful profession. As a social worker and working like in hospitals, and you do have a lot of power within a multidisciplinary team, because you are kind of, you're the outsider, and you don't have to get along with everyone, because your job is about advocating for the client's needs, yeah, and and offering a different perspective and offering the sort of critical reflection on this situation and questioning things like, why do we have to do that this way? Why can't we do it a different way? And you don't always make a lot of friends being a social worker, but you do make a lot of social work friends.
What do you see are the major keys to empowering the lives of Indigenous people, both locally and around the world?
It's a really, it's a really huge kind of question, isn't it? And I think there needs to be kind of avenues for us to be able to come together. You know, there's power in the collective. And I think our experience across the globe as Indigenous people is very similar, and the impacts of colonization across, you know, across Indigenous peoples across the world, like the impacts and the lasting kind of where we're at today, it's like people's experiences are similar, very different obviously for everyone, but like I guess the health outcomes and education and all of those kind of social determinants. If you break it all down, we're kind of like, there's a lot of similarities, and I think collectively we can make a difference. Like we can learn so much off one another, like say cultural safety. That was, you know, something that was developed and came out from nurses working with Maori people in New Zealand. And, you know, that's something that we've now adapting or starting to adapt. We've got a long way to go. I think we can learn so much from one another, and having these opportunities to be able to do that sort of cross continents and cross sort of cultural connections, I think that's really important. I remember going to an Indigenous health conference a couple of years ago and hearing this psychiatrist, she was a Sami psychiatrist in Norway, and talking about the mental health treatment for young Sami people. And it was like, it was so inspiring and so... kind of my breath was kind of taken away by it, because like their whole model was around family and around healing the young person through the family, and their health system allowed that. The young person wasn't seen as the person who had the illness or the sickness that needed to be individually treated. It was about, this is a problem within the family. We need to treat the whole family. So the whole family would go on this sort of camp together with a therapist or a counsellor or some kind of support person, and everyone would have goals they would need to sort of, I guess, achieve within that sort of holistic care. And one was about, you know, like learning to fish or building a heart, or, you know, like it was really like this completely different kind of thing to what I've ever seen us do over here. And I just think, you know, there's lots of people across the world in Indigenous communities doing really great things. And if we could come together, we can be sort of, you know, we can be more powerful. There's power in the people.
What is your unique vision for Indigenous people, both in Australia and around the world?
Well, I guess my unique vision for us is that I want us to be the leaders, the mainstream leaders. I want to see more Aboriginal people at the front and centre of different spaces and structures, and not just Aboriginal people being in identified positions and in tokenistic kind of roles, but Aboriginal people seen for the value of what they can provide as a, you know, as a whole. I think, like in Australia, I think there's still like this... real kind of misconception about Aboriginal people, and that we don't inhibit spaces, and we're not present, and we're not seen enough.
Hilary, thank you so much for the interview.
Thanks so much, Purple. It was lovely to see you.
It was so good to see you, and I hope to see you soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye.